Hold on. Welcome to Authors on the Air Radio. I'm Pam Stack, your host, and we're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I hope you're all doing well tonight on this first Monday of the week. We have plenty of wonderful shows lined up for you. Sorry that I'm having a little trouble with the internet tonight. I hope the broadcast is clear for you. I'm really excited tonight to have one of the best thriller novelist around with me tonight. John McGoran writes eco-thrillers, and I love that. His latest book is called Dust Up, which just released on, I will give you the exact date, on April 19. And I'm so happy that he's here to talk about his books, because he also writes books under another name. But in the meantime, let me welcome to the air John McGoran. Hi, John. Welcome to Authors on the Air.
Hi, Pam. Thank you so much. I really enjoy your show, and I'm very, very happy to be here.
Oh, thank you so much. So congratulations on your new release. I have been reading all of the wonderful reviews on it, particularly the editorial reviews, and I'm so thrilled that some of my friends from Out of the Gutter online also reviewed your book, and this is what they had to say. Doyle Carrick is a shark-tongued wise-ass it's hard not to like. Along with the quips and sarcasm, though, is an underlying sense of sobriety. You never lose sight of the real-world issues in play. The vulnerability of the world's food supply is a genuine concern. McGoran gives us wild chases and glib banter, but he does not let us forget the ever-present dangers regular people face. He blends his research into his storyline seamlessly, entertainment and serious thought. You can't take much more away from that than a thriller. Congratulations on those great reviews.
Yeah, thank you. That's very, very gratifying.
Yeah, Tom and Joe do a great job with that. I know they love your book. I don't know if you're aware that Tom Pitts is an author also in this network. So when I said that you were coming on the show, he was tickled. And so that's always great. But I have a question for you. Tom does a show called Skid Row Chatter with host Tom Pitts. So he's really terrific.
Sure, yeah, I've listened to his show before.
Yeah, he's really great. Very irreverent show, a little bit different from mine. You know, he does a lot of noir and pulp and all, and that's really great. Dark crime fiction. A little bit different from what I do. I'm a little bit cross-genre. But nevertheless, I'm thrilled that you're here. Now, you have in your bio a little note that says you are a member of the Liars Club. What does that mean, and what is the Liars Club?
I ask myself that all the time, actually. The Liars Club is this great organization that was started by Jonathan Mayberry and Gregory Frost in Philadelphia, kind of a group of authors. And it started out as a couple of it was their idea, and it was them, those two, and myself, and Leslie Banks, who unfortunately passed away a few years ago. And it started out as a couple of different things, and one was a way or a place where authors could kind of get together and compare notes. One of the things that they kind of realized early on was that there's a lot of there's a lot of support for writers who are trying, you know, in the first part of the slog, trying to get published. And, you know, you kind of develop these great networks of people and support and friendships and everything. And then you get published and you really can't, you know, the people, you know, if you're the first one in your group to get published, that, you know, you all of a sudden you're dealing with a lot of issues that you've never dealt with. And that the support network that has been so great can't really help you with either. So especially, you know, I guess it's probably been about almost 10 years that the group's been together. And wow. It's been such a time of incredible change in the publishing world.
Yeah.
It was a great place for, you know, published authors to kind of get together and compare notes and help each other out and bounce ideas. But very quickly, it kind of morphed into something that was a little more forward-thinking as well, and that is just kind of paying it forward as much as we can, doing things to support literacy and reading and writers and readers. We've done, you know, a series of events to support indie bookstores and to support libraries. We did an anthology that was in part a fundraiser to raise money for Leslie's medical expenses, and then unfortunately
right.
her you know, funeral expenses and her family. But we also we do have a thing called the Writer's Coffee House, which has kind of expanded beyond the Liars Club. Jonathan Mayberry, who, as I said, was one of the kind of founding members, he moved to San Diego a couple years back and kind of brought with him a lot of the energy and mojo and intelligence and goodwill that we had kind of been basking in around Philadelphia. But he also started a Writer's Coffee House there. And now there's several of them. I think there's one in L.A. There's one in Asheville, North Carolina, I believe.
Wow.
There's talk of one in Boston. I don't know if that started up yet. And in San Diego, where Jonathan is. And that is this great thing. It's this very kind of not amorphous, but casual monthly
right.
coffee house. Ours is at a Barnes & Noble. There's another one at an actual coffee house. And it's
wow.
for writers of, you know, every stripe to get together, talk a little bit about craft, but mostly about, you know, publishing and the writing life and whatever is bugging you, whether you're or sharing whatever you've learned and your good news, whether you're a New York Times bestseller or someone who is thinking about writing sometime. So it's great. Yeah.
It sounds like a really great support group, and I applaud your efforts. Please let me know what the network can do to help you out whenever you're doing fundraisers. We'd be happy to go ahead and participate. So let's move on a little bit. You write nonfiction, and you write satire, and you write under a pen name as well. Tell me about that first before we go on to Drift and Dust Up and all of those, because I'd like to hear your backstory a little bit.
Sure. Yeah, I do write a little bit of nonfiction these days, less than I have been because I've been pretty busy with the fiction.
Sure.
I did have I wrote an essay for an anthology last year, but my background is in food and sustainability and
mm-hmm.
kind of communications and public relations and journalism and advocacy, kind of that whole spectrum. For a long time, I worked at a place called Weaver's Way Co-op, which is a very large and well-established food co-op in Philadelphia that has a network of urban farms and has a nonprofit arm and does a lot of really cool stuff. And a lot of my job there was publishing a monthly newspaper. And so while I was kind of ramping up my fiction writing career, I was also, you know, I was writing murder and thrillers and some science fiction and a little bit of horror at night and writing about food sustainability during the day. And I find that world very fascinating. I think it's really a remarkable time in our history. It's just the way, you know, as my books kind of focus a lot on biotech topics, but just
yeah.
the way corporate biotech is really taking over a lot of things, it kind of plays into a lot of what I consider very legitimate concerns, but also, you know, really kind of lends itself towards all sorts of crazy kind of conspiracy type thrillers. So my background, I had written, as you said, I had written a few thrillers, three forensic thrillers under the pen name D.H. Dublin a few years back. My agent at the time was shopping one of my novels, and we got some really good feedback from Penguin, but they said it wasn't what they were looking for, and they wanted to know if I could write them a forensic series. So it wasn't that different from what I was writing. If a major publisher says, "Can you write it?" Yeah, you say yes. You know, that's how that
of
works.
Of course.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a question. How did you become involved in the food sustainability movement? Because that's not a mainstream thing that I hear most authors talking about. I do hear a lot of authors talking about preparedness and growing your own organic food and so on. And I understand that, and I'm all on board with that. But you seem to have focused on this one particular thing. Tell me why.
Well, you know, for me, you know, at the time, you know, I thought it was important and I thought it was fascinating. But again, I was spending my nights writing murder and mayhem and spending my days writing about, you know, what was happening with this huge change in the technology of the food we eat. And in a lot of ways, the food stuff that I was writing was scarier than the murder mysteries that I was writing, you know?
Are you talking about GMOs and such?
That's the primary thing. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of weird stuff that is going on with the food, you know, from factory farms and, you know, huge amounts of antibiotics and, all sorts of, you know, pesticides and herbicides and cloning and irradiation and all these
things.
So it's
not like growing
things.
A backyard garden anymore, nor is it like raising a couple cows on the family farm. Everything has changed.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's a change, you know, a lot of these changes started taking place 50 or 60 or 70 years ago. And I think that the fact that a lot of people were aware of that kind of gave cover to some of the changes that have been going on in the last 15 or 20 years. So people were like, oh, yeah, I know it's not, you know, old Farmer Jones or McDonald or whatever. But, you know, it's still food. I think they were, you know, one of the things that kind of shocked me when I first, I was kind of deciding what was that I wanted to write about next. And I was alarmed by the things that I was writing about journalistically. I was really alarmed by how few people knew about it. And I think these days people are much more savvy about it than they were. But at the time it was kind of alarming to me that 90% of, you know, a lot of our commodity foods had been switched over to genetically engineered crops and nobody knew about it. So on one hand, I really felt compelled to talk about it because I thought it was important, but I also thought, wow, this is a legit and very thriller oriented premise. You've got,
you're not kidding.
Again and again, but it's true. It's shadowy multinational corporations pushing untested new life forms into the food supply of an unsuspecting public. And it's like, okay, well, that's a great jumping off point in my mind for a good science thriller. And once I realized that's where I was going to look, there was just so many ideas to write about. There were so many different aspects of it that bore exploration and lent themselves to what I think were some pretty cool thriller plots.
Well, obviously, because you've gotten so many rave reviews. By the way, I love your covers. I'm a big believer in a great cover, and Dust Up has one of the best I've seen in a long time. Let's go back and talk about the beginning of this particular series. Which would you say starts you off on the road to doing eco-thrillers?
From a news standpoint, or which issue?
Would Dead Out be the first one that you did?
No. Drift was the first in the series, and Dead Out was the second. And then there was a novella that came out about a month ago, Down to Zero, which is also part of the series, which takes place between Dead Out and Dust Up.
Okay. Let's talk about this because, you know, it's really interesting. I'm looking at all your reviews. You really have some magnificent reviews for all the work that you're doing for your books. And congratulations on that, because breaking into this market has not always been easy, has it been?
No, it's definitely not. and definitely it's, you know, I definitely don't feel like I've cracked. You know, I've got a lot of work to do to try to get the series out there. And I think, you know, I think that the topic of the books, the themes and issues that I kind of write about, I think add a lot to the books themselves. But I think that there are, you know, people like, I think it sometimes presents an obstacle. People are like, I don't want to be lectured at, or I don't want to be, you know, dealing with, you know, I just want a good read. And one of the things that, you know, I am very, very, very much, first and foremost, I'm a storyteller, you know, and anytime, one of the things that I've learned and that has really become kind of central to me as a writer is that anything that gets in the way of story has to take a back seat, you know, whether it's a joke. And, you know, I mean, I like to have a really good line or something that's important, or some crazy little factoid that I have learned during my research, and I'm like dying to get it into the book because I think it's really, really, really cool. But if it doesn't further the story, it just has to go, you know, and always story has to be first. So, you know, one of the things that's been a challenge for me is to kind of to get people to read the book and not think that it's going to be a slog, or not think that it's going to be pedantic or lecturing or anything.
Right. You're not proselytizing to anyone. Absolutely.
Let's talk about
Drift then. Let's start with Drift. Is this where we meet Doyle Carrick?
Yes.
Pretend like we're in the elevator, but it's a really tall building, so you have plenty of time to give me the premise of Drift, okay? And tell me about Doyle and how you discovered him.
Okay, am I allowed to slap the emergency button if I feel
you are
stop the elevator?
You
okay,
are.
Great.
It's all about you, John. So whatever you want, you can say.
I like to say there's a great line in Shrek where Shrek is talking about the talking donkey. And somebody says, "Oh, a talking donkey," and he says, "Yeah, it's getting them to shut up. That's the trick." So I kind of identify with that remark. So
no, this is all about you. So you get to talk about whatever you want. All right. So let's start with Drift, because I like the title of the book. I like the cover that you have, and I like the premise of the story. So tell listeners about Drift.
So Drift is the first book in the series, and it starts out with the main character, my protagonist, Doyle Carrick, who's a Philadelphia narcotics detective. And very, very quickly, in the first couple of chapters, both his mother and his stepfather die of natural causes, one of, you know, cancer and one of a broken heart. And he inherits their house out in the Pennsylvania countryside. And he also inherits, a 30-day suspension because he kind of misbehaves on the job, you know, related to he decks his partner to speed up a bus. he's monitoring his partner, who is undercover, and he goes to bust the guy who his partner's making a buy from. And in order to make it look good, he has to deck his partner. So that it will look legit. So he gets suspended for that. And basically, while he's out in the countryside, kind of putting his parents' affairs in order and kind of getting to know them in a way that he hadn't really done while they were alive, he develops a relationship with a woman, the woman who owns the farm next door. And she's an organic farmer, and she's very lovely, and weird things start to happen on her farm. And one of the things is that her organic crops start growing funny. And one of the things that is a real threat for organic farmers around the world is if farms growing genetically modified crops are too close, or even if they're not that close, it's just really windy, they can get drift. And there have been a number, I mean, there have been a lot of cases of this where farmers have lost their organic certification and because they're no longer organic, because all of a sudden they're growing genetically modified crops unintentionally. So she's also kind of getting pressure to sell her land. He kind of starts looking into it, and at the same time he starts seeing some familiar faces from his narcotics work in Philadelphia, and he realizes some drug gangs working out there. So he kind of pursues the case from these two different angles, and it kind of starts to meet in the middle. One of the things that, you know, when I first started thinking about writing about GMOs and biotech, you know, one of the things that I thought was really cool and potentially a little alarming was this notion of biofarming, which is something that is, you know, that is done today. It's not on a huge, wide scale.
What does that mean? What is biofarming? What does that mean?
So biofarming is when food crops are genetically modified to produce pharmaceuticals. So it's a really powerful technology, and it makes a lot of good sense in certain ways. You know, it's a way to produce drugs more cheaply if it can be done. But there are concerns about it. And one of the concerns with all the GMOs is what happens if they get out and they spread. So there's a couple of different things going on. And I can't go into too much detail about, like, where it
right.
leads to. But
right,
there's designer
right.
pathogens, and there's this kind of other pharmaceutical issues. And what I swear to God to this day is the most sinister application of monarch butterflies that has yet to occur in fiction. But I can't say what, because that would give away too much. Even after, you know, it's been out for a couple of years.
So you finished up Drift in 2013, and then went on to write a book called Dead Out. And Dead Out is kind of a follow-up, because you have the same character there. You have Doyle Carrick, your former police guy, or away from police at the time. And he's still with your female protagonist, Nola, but, you know, kind of in a not-so-steady way. What happens that changes in Dead Out, and why the title of the book?
I knew I was going to write a sequel, and I knew that it was, you know, it was going to deal with a lot of the same issues. You know, as I said earlier, one of the things that really struck me about the whole biotech world and how much of our food supply had been changed so dramatically. One of the things that struck me most about it was how little people knew about it, that people were largely
right.
unaware that this huge shift in food technology had taken place unbeknownst to them. When I was trying to think of different ideas for what the sequel was going to be about, one of the things that was going on at the time was colony collapse disorder and the honeybees dying all over the place. And again, that was something that, you know, to me, I mean, it seemed like, and the experts still say, that it has the potential to be an existential threat. I mean, again, I think a quarter of the bees in the United States died last year.
Right.
44% of the colonies died, which it's just, you know, staggering numbers.
Right.
So,
and we cannot grow anything without honeybees. Most people may not know that. I was born and raised in Miami, and south of me in Homestead used to be the second largest producer of vegetables next to California in the state, and unfortunately, it's lost that. It's just not true anymore.
Yeah, no, it's,
because and I remember seeing honeybee hives next to all the crops and all the fields, and having wondering why in the world do they have flowers planted next to all the tomato plants and so on. But there is a reason for it all. And if we lose honeybees, we're really screwed, aren't we, John?
Yeah, no, really, it's very alarming, and you know, it's like kind of the prequel to a lot of post-apocalyptic scenarios that are out there. So,
sure.
You know, when I talk about my books, you know, people do sometimes say, well, you know, why did you write thrillers about this stuff? And I think that almost all thrillers borrow a sense of danger and menace from real world scenarios. You know, if you're writing about terrorists, you know, there's real terrorists out there. You're kind of borrowing from the horror that they wreak. And you know, during the Cold War, you know, the Soviet Union was a real threat. You know, there are these real threats out there, and I think this is one of them. So for me, with the bees, it was this kind of existential threat that, again, at the time when I was first starting to write about it, nobody was talking about, and I was kind of alarmed that this huge thing was going on, and people were largely unaware of it. But also, bees are just really fascinating, and colony collapse is really fascinating. You know, one of the things, you know, I was doing research about it, and the way it struck. Was just, it's really compelling, you know. So colony collapse is when the worker bees fly out in the morning and they just never come back. And they actually are never found, which is kind of remarkable that, you know, even after all these years and after these billions and billions and billions of bees have disappeared, they just kind of vanish without a trace. And, you know, it's like, I don't think they're being raptured and I don't think they're being abducted by aliens.
They are dying because of chemical and pesticides and everything else in our environment, because as hardy as they may be, they're still not a human being. They still are an insect and very vital to our survival, just the same way as like you mentioned earlier, monarch butterflies are too, correct?
Absolutely. So, you know, one of the things with the bees, it's kind of remarkable that you know, these isolated incidents of colony collapse has been observed over the last, you know, 70, 80, 100 years, just here and there. You know, the occasional beekeeper would, you know, observe it. But in 2006, there was a beekeeper, and he was a Pennsylvania beekeeper, but he was kind of wintering his hives in Florida, and he had 16 million hives in, you know, parks and fields on flatbeds.
Wow.
And one day they go out and 12 million of his bees have vanished. And so he calls the USDA, and they're kind of freaking out because they've never seen this happen before. And this was in 2006, and that summer 23% of the bees in the United States vanished. And every year since then, between 23 and 30% of the bees in the country have disappeared. So it really is kind of like this remarkable, weird, crazy thing that's going on. So in Dead Out, one of the things that the book is about is that, you know, a biotech company kind of steps up and says that they've developed a genetically engineered honeybee that is immune to colony collapse. And it was one of those things that, you know, I had the idea for it and I started researching it. And when I started researching it, there was no talk of that at all. There were genetically modified mosquitoes, which have been in the news again lately because of Zika. And there were robot honeybees being worked on, little like robotic honeybees to pollinate crops. But there was no talk of genetically engineered honeybees. And within, I think, 6 or 8 months of the book's release, Monsanto announced that they were working on genetically engineered honeybees that would be immune to colony collapse.
Very interesting. So now you've released a new book called Dust Up. And Dust Up is the third of the series. involving Doyle Carrick, and he is still trying to figure out what's going on, but he's still doing his work as a detective. Tell us a little bit now about Dust Up. And I want to know where the title came from, too, because I now understand where the two titles in previously have come from. Explain where Dust Up came from.
Well, so I will say, so Drift, you know, the title for Drift, when I had the idea for the book, I was like, okay, there's what it's going to be about, and it's going to be this guy, and he's going to do this stuff, and it's going to be called Drift. So it was like I had the name for the book.
I love it. He's going to do this stuff. There's going to be a guy. It's almost that simple, isn't it? It really is.
It really is. You know, cut to 90,000 words later.
Right.
But with Dead Out, actually, I really struggled with the title.
Why did you decide on that title?
Well, so it was pretty fascinating. I was pretty much done the second draft of the book, and I had, you know, the top half of the first page of the manuscript was just this kind of horrible stream of consciousness poem of really bad working titles.
It was just awful.
So I knew that I did not have a title, and I knew it was really kind of getting down to the wire. So I would be up until 2 a.m. doing copy edits and line edits, and then from 2 to 3, I would freak out over what the title of the book was going to be.
Oh, God,
it was terrible. And I'm like reading all these old poems about honey. And at one point, I had this great idea. There's this thing that, you know, the bee smokers, the things that they use to squirt the smoke at the bees.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking,
oh,
I wonder if there's, you know, an antique smoker with a really cool name that might be for sale on eBay or something. So
You were really grasping at straws, weren't you?
Oh my God, it was horrible. It was really, really bad.
That's so funny.
My wife is a children's librarian, and I was asking her to bring home. You know, I was asking her to bring home all these books that I was ordering from the library to skim through and see if I could get anything. I asked her to bring home some children's books, and I couldn't believe that I hadn't come across this before. Because it was so incredibly perfect. But she brought home this one book it was a children's picture book about honeybees, and it talked a lot about colony collapse. And in the back, there's a glossary, and I squealed like a little girl. I scared the hell out of my wife. It was like 3 a.m. When I found it. But a dead out is what the beekeepers call a hive that has been hit by colony collapse.
There you go. That was perfect.
It was perfect.
There
you
go.
So I kind of,
you have, John, don't you know, behind every successful man is a woman with a plan.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It's very true in this case. Very, very true.
I hope that you're giving her lots of cred for that. I really do.
For that and so much more.
There you go.
Yeah.
Smart man.
The good news was I had a great title, but then the bad news was that they both began with D, which was kind of cool, but now you kind of established a precedent, and it really kind of narrows things down.
There you go.
So with Dust Up, you know, there it works. I mean, in my mind, it's it works great because of some of the technology and some of the kind of the nuts and bolts of the plot, but also a lot of what it's about is how some of the large multinational corporations are really, really aggressive with pressuring other countries to loosen or remove the restrictions that they have on GMOs. You know, most of the countries in the world have much more stringent restrictions than we do in this country. And the, you know, companies like Monsanto and the other biotech companies and big food companies, you know, they want to remove any of the barriers to their products.
Right.
And the U.S. government actually does a lot of their work for them.
Yes,
you know,
they do.
Applying,
I agree.
Yeah. They apply a lot of pressure, you know, through trade agreements and food aid packages and stuff like that. So there's a couple of different things. And also the book takes place in Haiti, which, you know, I visited, to research the book, and it's an incredibly dusty place. I was very happy with the title because I think it worked on a number of levels.
So I want to talk to you a little bit. You said something that kind of caught my ear here. You talked about research. Obviously, there is a lot in the news and a lot of squawking over social media about GMOs, and particularly the Monsanto Corporation. I am fairly cautious about what I consume, but you never can be sure because, unfortunately, we are not the FDA does not require labeling on food products. And so you really don't ever know, except for those companies that say not GMO.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how difficult is it to find that? So you talked about research. Tell me how difficult it is to research something like this. Now, obviously, you had an entree into the world that you're building because this is something that you had blogged about and you had worked with anyway. But let me know – tell me a little bit about research. You went to Haiti. Haiti's not far from where I live. I was born and raised in Miami. I have a lot of Asian friends. It is a country that is so poor and has so many difficulties that I remember when GMOs first came out and people were saying, but this is going to double your crop. You're going to be able to feed your starving citizens and, you know, children will not go hungry anymore. But truly, that's not the case, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, it's, you know, it's been mixed. You know, so the GMOs, they do some of what they say they will do. And what seems to be the case is that they do most of what they say they're going to do for a few years. And then kind of nature, you know, in the form of superweeds and resistant pests, kind of catches up with them. And then the farmers find themselves in the situation of paying all this extra money for the GMO seeds, using the glyphosate, the Roundup or whatever, on them, but then also having to go back and use more of the older, the stronger chemicals that they were told they would not have to use anymore. So, you know, initially the first couple of years, the chemical inputs go down and the yields go up, and the farmers make more money, but then the yields go down, the chemical inputs start creeping back up again, and they're still paying more for the seed. And now they're kind of addicted to it because the weeds have become resistant and the pests have become resistant. So it's harder for them to go back to the non-GMO crops afterwards. But I will say, I mean, I think the research, I find it fascinating, but I find it really, really frustrating as well. You know, this is something that, you know, the forensic books that I wrote required a tremendous amount of research as well. And it was a lot of work, but it was, you know, it was great fun. It was fascinating. It was a great part about one of the things I really liked about writing those books. But one of the things, there's the third book in the series, which is my favorite, and I want to give it a shout out. It's called Freezer Burn. It's a hoot, but part of what it's about, what it's primarily about, is cryonic preservation, involves people, you know, freezing themselves after they die or having themselves frozen immediately after death in hopes that they can be resuscitated. And it, you know, it might be ridiculous that they, you know, who knows, they might be right. There's no way of telling because, you know, you can't prove it or disprove it until the future. But it does,
right.
I will say as an aside, frozen bodies give you all sorts of great, crazy, cool things to do forensically. But one of the things that I learned was that when you are researching controversial topics, people have a viewpoint. And with cryonic preservation, the people, the foremost experts in the field were either debunkers who thought it was crazy and ridiculous, and people who were actually trying to do it and had a vested interest in promoting it, you know, and they believed sincerely in it. So I remember, like, again and again, I would have these highly technical questions, and I would get very different answers depending on the viewpoint of the expert that I was interviewing.
And a lot of passion, I would imagine. A lot of, instead of just having the facts, ma'am, you had a lot of personal conjecture and personal opinion, no matter what.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of it is, you know, these are legitimate interpretations of the facts, but they
sure.
go in very different directions. And the realm of GMOs is a very contentious and controversial issue. You do have people who share a lot of my concerns with them, and some of them kind of misstate and overstate things, you know, maybe through carelessness or because they're ill-informed or because they're trying to be sensational. But on the other side, you definitely have this huge, huge industry that has a lot of money at stake and is investing a lot
sure.
of money in promoting their products. And the way that they primarily promote their products, you know, as I said before, when GMOs first came out, the first 15 years almost, very few people were aware that this revolution had happened. And that was not by accident. I mean, it was done intentionally, quietly.
Honestly say I had no idea it was has been around that long.
Yeah, it was.
So
it was remarkable.
You came to David versus Goliath type scenario, wouldn't you say?
Yeah,
because you
I
have
would.
People
I would.
Who are
absolutely
who are just like trying to figure it out, and so you have local groups or advocacy groups or, you know, people who are saying, wait a minute, this isn't a good thing. And yet you have multi-billion-dollar corporations who are saying, oh, yes, they are. It's fine. And
yeah.
So who do you believe?
And,
you know, it's difficult.
Yeah. No, it is. And the, you know, so there's this very quiet rollout. And then there was this very intentional effort to kind of muddy the waters and prevent research from being done. You know, there's been,
sure.
you know, people say, oh, we've been eating GMOs for 20 years and there's no evidence that they're bad for you. And I mean, there is some evidence, but there's also evidence that they're not, but there's very, very, very little science. You know, there's no epidemiological studies. There's very little in
sure.
the way of long-term safety studies. And you look at like a lot of these kind of weird syndromes and illnesses and things like, you know, celiac and autism and Alzheimer's and food
sure.
allergy, all these things that have kind of
and you really, wonder, right?
You wonder, and
right.
and there is no evidence. There's no evidence that there's any connection, and there very well might not be. But it's ridiculous. It's kind of crazy that this huge change in food technology has gone by, and it's been happening for 20 years, and we still don't have the research to prove it one way or another. You know.
Right.
So now, you know, now the thing is they're fighting labeling, you know, the last few years. So every step along the way, there's been this kind of effort by consumers to find out what's going on and this effort by the biotech industry and big food to prevent them from knowing what's going on. And you know, and they could be totally innocuous. You know, there could be, you know, I mean, I think,
well, you don't know until there's an independent study and long-term studies. So you have these the people versus the big giant company. So who's to know?
Exactly.
John, I want to ask you a little bit about your writing. You mentioned earlier, it caught my ear, that you said you were writing in the middle of the night. Is that fairly typical for you to write late during the day?
You know, it kind of changes a bit, but I mean, yes, I think primarily I am a late night writer. That's one of the times that I'm most productive and conversely early in the morning as well. Those kind of two extremes of the day. You know, for the last couple of years, I've been writing pretty much full time. So I kind of have the flexibility to do that, which has been great. So a lot of times, you know, if I'm in a project and I'm getting work done, it's very hard to, you know, you don't want to stop, you know.
Sure.
So
no, if you're in the zone, you want to keep going, right?
Exactly.
When you're in the
exactly.
zone, that's a precious place to be, and so you want to keep writing. So let me ask you,
yes.
do you have any kind of weird writing mojo or juju that you have to do? I mean, do you have to be like in a certain place that's completely sealed off from the rest of the life around you? Can you let music in? Do you let, you know, are you in a place that you have a beautiful view outside? What does your writing cave do for you? How is it conducive to your writing?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, when I was writing the D.H. Dublin books, I was under very, very tight deadlines. It was very tight for me at the time, because I was working full time, and it was 385,000 word manuscripts in 18 months.
Wow.
And I had a young son, and I was kind of the primary caregiver for my mom. You know, I was the only local person, and, you know, she had a lot of health issues, a lot of doctor's appointments, stuff like that. And I would do all that. So I got really good at writing wherever. You know, I got a lot of good writing done in doctor's waiting rooms with my mom. I remember when the first book came out, I did an interview with Philadelphia City Paper, which was a great fault weekly in Philadelphia, which very, very sadly just closed, ceased publication a couple of months ago. Yeah, it was very sad. They were kind enough to do a story about me when the book came out, and I told them how, you know, I didn't want my writing to take away time from my son, but, you know, sometimes you have to, especially, you know, when you've got an intense deadline. So I said, you know, I would spend time. I guess he was like five at the time. You know, we would have our quality time, and then we would have some SpongeBob time. And I would be, you know, writing my, you know, forensic thrillers, sitting next to him, kind of pretending to watch SpongeBob. And I'll never forget, I mean, I just kind of mentioned this toss-up, the subhead of the article, I forget what the headline was, but it was, you know, Philly crime writer Steve writes mayhem while watching SpongeBob. And I was like, yeah, that really does a lot for my literary credibility here, you know.
But, you know, you write on the fly when you can in certain situations like that, don't you? I mean, if you have the desire to write, you're going to find a time and a place to do it, regardless of what the circumstances are around you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, deadlines will make you do that. But also, you know, as you said earlier, when you're in the zone,
right.
You know, you want to steal every minute you can to get back to it, you know, because.
And to stay there, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
That's so funny.
So the other thing I would say is I seem to always like trains and buses. And even while I'm driving, you know, I get lots of great ideas. So I can't actually, you know, haul out my laptop while I'm driving. But I do use my, the voice recognition on my phone a lot when I'm driving. And you know, if it's a long drive, I'll come up with a lot of ideas that, you know, about new projects or about some, you know, things that I'm working on. But being on the train is great. I love riding on the train. Yeah, it's great.
That's great.
I know a couple
okay,
people.
So now you triggered another question. You talked about, you know, you have an idea and you pull out your phone and you're going to go ahead and, of course, make a note of it to yourself. So I would imagine at the end of a certain period of time, you have quite a few ideas going on there. When it comes time to sit down and write something new, how do you choose which of those ideas you're going to write?
It's really hard.
Yeah, how do you know which one is worthy, which one has legs? You know, I'm sure you always start your books with what if, and I don't know a fiction writer who doesn't. But, you know, you've got this great hand across the blackjack table, and you've got all these great cards. Which one do you play?
It's a problem. It really is. And it can, you know, there have been times, that's the closest, I mean, I don't really, you know, knock on wood, you'll take my word, I'm actually physically knocking on wood, but I haven't had much trouble with writer's block. You know, that's not something that I've struggled with. I mean, sometimes it's hard, sometimes it's easy, but it's, you know, it's always writing, and, you know, that's, you know, I've never been just, you know, stymied like that. But there have been times, and right now I'm kind of, you know, I've got a couple of things going on, and I'm fairly deep into several projects, and I have not decided for sure which one is the one. And a couple of them are, you know, projects that I'm, you know, about to sign contracts for, and those will obviously, you know, step to the front of the line. But
right.
There's several books, and I've been writing a bunch of short stories lately, which has been a lot of fun. But it's kind of slowing me down, this indecisiveness. I mean, it can be a problem, you know. I mean, that's the sometimes that's the hardest thing about writing, you know. Even if you're in a project, you know, things can kind of come to a halt when you come to a decision that you have to make, and it's really six of one and a half a dozen of the other, you know, or
do
it's
I continue or do I start something new? Has that happened to you?
Or even, you know, should it be a green sweater or a blue sweater? You know, should she
really?
Be a doctor or should she be a lawyer? You know, and it's like you think about all the different possibilities going down either of those roads. And it can, you know, that can bring things to a halt. You know, and sometimes you just have to think it through, and sometimes you just have to flip a coin, you know?
That's interesting. I didn't realize that. That's fascinating. You know, you've written cross genre. You've done a lot of different things, but I want to come back to your short stories. I love the fact that you do write short stories, because I think that's a sign of a terrific writer when they can write a fully fledged story in a short form or in a flash fiction form. Do you find that sharpens your writing skills, John?
Yeah, I definitely do. I definitely do. I think that, you know, short stories are great. They're a pain in the ass, you know, because you do spend a lot of time on them. I was just reading a foreword that Laura Lippman had written for the Best American Mystery Stories a year or two back. And she's talking about how, you know, you could write 20,000 words of a novel in the time it takes you to write 3,000-4,000 words in a short story.
Sure.
So the opportunity costs are really high. There's a lot of stuff you're not doing when you're writing a short story. But I do think that it helps you, you know, I mean, I value economy very highly in writing.
Oh, absolutely.
And short stories really, you know, that's what they're all about.
They force you to look
at
that, don't they? They force you to look at an economy of words, as my dear friend Jeffrey Deaver says all the time. An economy of words is the best way to write. And of course, as you know, Dutch Leonard always talked, don't write what the reader doesn't want to read. So
yep,
you know, there's
the
a lot to be said. Exactly. So there's a lot to be said for that. What's next on your list of things to do, John?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I'm working on a couple of media tie-in projects, and I can't announce quite yet, but we're pretty far along.
You'll come back and tell me about them.
Yeah, I would love to. I would definitely love to.
Great. Good.
I've got several short stories out of submission. I actually have a I have a science fiction story, a horror story, and a crime story out on submission at the same time, which just kind of tickles me. There's really three novels that I'm most intently working on, not including the media tie-in work.
That's fabulous.
I'm torn. I've been doing a lot of work on an unrelated, probably standalone, maybe series, adult thriller, a near future thriller, and then one that is more a little more far out science fiction, more straight science fiction, which would be my first book length science fiction. I've written a lot of science fiction short stories. And I also have a YA science fiction thriller, an idea that I really, really like for a middle grade science fiction thriller. And I've kind of had to put that off to the side just because,
Let me just say, when those all get done, I will introduce you to the host of our science fiction spotlight radio show. because he is a military science fiction author himself, a bestseller, H. Paul Hunziker, and he loves talking to authors who write science fiction. So you'll definitely go and talk to him. And you mentioned that you have a horror book going on. Jonathan Mayberry knows our host for Thorn and Cross Haunted Nights Live. They would love to have you too, I know. So, you know, is it fun to stretch your literary muscles by challenging yourself with new genres?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, for me, as, I have a lot of ideas, you know, and they go in a lot of directions. And sometimes, you know, they're really dark, you know.
That's okay.
But,
I love dark crime fiction. That's great. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's fabulous.
Yeah,
you got to kind of feed the beast, though, don't you? When you're a writer, you really don't have control over what's going to come out of your fingers when you get on the laptop. So that's an important thing. John, I'm so glad that you came, and I've taken up so much of your time already, way more than I had planned to. I cannot thank you enough for being with me tonight on Authors on the Air. Will you come back?
I would love to come back. I would love to come back.
Would you come
you
back
ask.
And would you come back and do an interview with one of your writer friends? And I'll let you have the microphone, and I'll just sit back and listen.
Oh, sure, that would be great.
Okay, so let's plan it, shall we?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
All right. I've been talking to the wonderful, very talented John McGoran. His new book is Dust Up. Go now and get this book. And don't forget, when you read, please review. It's really, really important to thank an author by doing that. John, I can't thank you enough for being with me tonight. Tomorrow night, I am going to be talking to Les Edgerton and Revis Wortham and a few other writers who are in a writer's retreat in San Antonio. That's going to be fun on Wednesday. Ward Larson, don't go away, folks. It's going to be simply the best here. John, you're the best. You and I will talk, yes?
All right, thanks, Pam. I look forward to it. And thanks for
I look forward
for
to
the review.
Absolutely. It's very, very important. Please review. That's the way you give kind of a kiss on the cheek to all the authors who spend their time writing for you. Have a great night, John. Thank you for being with me.
Thanks, you too, Pam. Good night.
Okay, have a good night. And thank you for being with me, folks. I'll be talking to you tomorrow night on a live remote from San Antonio. I have no idea what's going on, but it should be fun. Have a great night. Thank you. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.